When it comes to the conflict in Ukraine, how do you find the current phase of the conflict in Ukraine? Do you see it goes to some sort of escalations, or we gonna have some sort of sanity?
Well, I'm hoping it won't go towards an escalation. My hope is placed in the Russians because they're the only adults on the field right now. I would call the current leadership in the United States and Europe, Western Europe, basically strategic indolence. I mean, it's like they seem to be unable to understand what is happening in front of them. And this recent NATO meeting, it was like it was almost like a Monty Python skit. I mean, people coming up with ideas that show they don't have the foggiest idea about what the actual situation is, and it tends to confirm and reconfirm that the political leadership in Europe is completely without even the most basic understanding of what's going on. And this is frightening to me. When I was in the Pentagon, I had very good friends, many military officers I worked with, who had a very different view of the world than I had. I was always open with them. We were good friends, so, and tolerant of each other. And these guys would, typically have the standard American demonized view of the Soviet Union at that time. And that's sort of the way I'm beginning to look at the Western leadership. They are so out of touch that I'm beginning to, well, I am feeling alarmed. I shouldn't say that I'm beginning to. And I've even had some informal discussions with people who see themselves as in touch with the administration. And those discussions are just as alarming. The people involved just don't know this. I have very black humor. People who know me have, and there is a scene in a very funny but dark film called The Producers. Mel Brooks did this. And Mel Brooks is one of these producers, and he comes into this to visit this man. And the man's name is Hans. That's all we know about him. And when they come into the man's home, it's filled with Nazi paraphernalia. And he's wearing a Nazi war helmet. And Brooks, who's playing this role of the producer, he asks him, "Hans, what did you do in the war?" And Hans says, "What war?" And that's the way I feel when I listen to these people talking. It's frightening.
Yeah. In your opinion, what where does this hatred come from? Do they really hate Russia and the way that Putin manages Russia, or the main goal is China and they're trying to just smash Russia and then go after China?
I think it's all of the above plus other things. First of all, I've been educating myself on this issue, because of what's been going on and following events. And I always thought, until quite recently, because I'm not trained as a historian, I'm trained as a scientist. I always thought that it all started with the Bolsheviks, and that the Bolsheviks just scared the hell out of so many Western elites. But I think the problems with Russia go back much further. Russia was really a great power by the time, certainly by the time of Catherine the Great. And she greatly expanded Russia's area of control, just as leaders in that time period were inclined to do, and was quite successful. And of course, after her, there were other successful expansions or consolidations of Russian power. And if you think of Russia as a European power, which I think it is, even though it's also Asian, it is for a long time the largest power in Europe. And although Russia was traditionally very backward, it posed a gigantic military threat to the European powers, and people were afraid of it for a very long time. And so I think it extends back to hundreds of years, certainly to the Crimean War, where you can see all of the same arguments being made, just as they are being made now, about the Russians expanding. And of course, then, as it is now, this is all fiction. I mean, you're now seeing statements made about Russia, the next target is Western Europe. That's not the only arguments that are made. Now, if you simply do the most simple-minded, basic historical review, you can see that, Germany, Nazi Germany, had well over 11 million soldiers under arms when it basically ran over Europe. When the Soviet Union finally defeated the Nazi invasion, Operation Barbarossa, they had basically over 11 million soldiers under arms. The Russian army today, which has been expanded greatly and, of course, is in many ways, I think, an extraordinarily powerful, maybe the most powerful land army currently in the world, that's going to have 1.5 million when the full expansion is finished. That's not an army. I mean, Hitler used 1.5 million soldiers to take over Poland in 1941, I think it was. So all of this is fiction. Whatever people think the mind of Mr. Putin is carrying, which I think is much clearer, or he's much more well thought out and sober than any of these people. Whatever they think of him is it's completely disconnected with the most simple understanding of the basic capabilities that Russia would have if it had these intentions. And I think, from my point of view, the United States in particular, American leadership, has made so many disastrously bad decisions with regard to our relationship with Russia, which I've been involved in for a long time because I've had Russian students and in a program I had at MIT. We've made so many terribly bad decisions that we needed to explain our failures in some simple-minded way to the American public. So what you do is you take this guy Putin and you blame it all on him. He certainly is an extraordinarily strategic thinker. He is impressively deep. He has an extraordinary grasp of detail that does not get overrun by a failure to understand the big picture. And he's truly an impressive world leader. And yes, he has problems in his personal and political history, but who on the world stage is free of that kind of criticism? So it seems to me that Putin is very, very far from the demon and the demonized individual that he's been made out to be. But he is a wonderful vehicle for blaming all your failures on, because after all, I wasn't stupid enough to push the Russians into China's arms by my policies as the United States did. So it was Putin. You know, this guy is so sleazy and so slippery. He all of a sudden lined up with China. Of course, the fact that our policies, American policies, push Russia into China's arms and actually China into Russia's arms. Oh, that has nothing to do with our ill-considered policies. It has to do with this sleazy guy, Xi Jinping, and this really sleazy guy, Vladimir Putin. It's just a fake way of transferring the guilt, or what you'd call the error, the stupidity of the decision making that has led to the current environment and situation onto a scapegoat that you can use to keep your population from understanding how incompetently you have managed U.S. foreign policy. That's the way I look at Putin. He's just a scapegoat. Now, I think it's a big mistake to do this because they become the victims of their own propaganda. So, you know, I'm sorry to laugh. I had a discussion with this Mike McFaul. You probably know who he is. He's this former ambassador who got himself thrown out of Russia. He likes to portray himself as having somehow played some heroic status. He got thrown out because he was so idiotic in his behavior. And I'm talking with him because I'm part-time. I'm out in California near Stanford. And I say to him, what do you think is happening in this war? He has just come out of a seminar where he has asked the speaker, what does the speaker think all these weapons will do to change the outcome? This was in January 30. Well, this was right before the catastrophic collapse of Avdiivka. You know, I was daily watching the Russian troops in the middle of Avdiivka being supported by these incredibly precise bombing from the air. So the troops were actually able to be close and engaging Ukrainian forces while the Russian Air Force was so precise in its bombing that it wasn't causing a lot of collateral damage on its own forces. And marveling, marveling at the military capability, you know, professionalism of this military, for also marveling, I must say, at the Ukrainians who really stood their ground under just extraordinary conditions. I have to say, the heroism these soldiers have shown in Ukraine is extraordinary. Their leadership has betrayed them repeatedly, but the soldiers, the Ukrainian soldiers, have shown extraordinary bravery. And just watching this thing go on, and this guy I'm talking to, who has just had a seminar where they're talking about Ukrainian victory, literally, he doesn't even know there's a war going on. He's my Hans, you know. And when I pressed him, he just simply had no answer. I actually expected him to come back with some nonsense, some kind of silly claims, but he literally had no idea of what was going on. He had no knowledge at any level. I was stunned. I was prepared for a debate where he would make some false claim and I would, confront them with it. He didn't even know what to say. And this is the, you know, here's a guy who's, you know, he's heading this sanctions group for the United States and Ukraine. I don't think he understands that the Russian economy has flowered under the sanction regime. I don't think he understands that the Western European powers have suffered outlandishly from this. From this situation. Blinken goes to China and he threatens the Chinese with sanctions when the American economy is overwhelmingly more dependent on Chinese imports then the Chinese are dependent on our imports. So who's going to suffer this elevated sanctions war that I think is going to happen? I hope it won't, but I think it's going to happen. It's going to be the American economy and the average American. And I look at these people and I say, you know, I'm a physicist by training. You know, I wish I knew more history because I'm aware of its importance, but I don't, because I'm spent most of my energy understanding the sciences. But how can I know basic economics and basic historical facts at so much basic, you know, easy, you know, straightforward a level than these people who are trained as political scientists? You look at these key, their backgrounds, they're trained as lawyers or political scientists. How can they not know such basic things about the social functions of our societies? It's just, I find that I'm just overwhelmed with astonishment.
You talk about the Russian army. Russia, before this conflict in Ukraine started, had a defensive army. They were prepared to defend their country. And right now, how do you see the transformation of the Russian army during these 2 years that they have been fighting, not Ukrainians, but Ukrainians together with NATO?
Yes, well, I have been amazed, not so much because they're Russians and everybody thinks they're monkeys, at least in the West. I've been amazed at the high level of innovation that the military in Russia has shown in their development of combat techniques against not only the Ukrainians, but also the West. Their innovative use of drones, of course, the Ukrainians have tried to use drones innovatively, but the Russians have very quickly understood how to negate these drones by, you know, these drones require communications lines. And the Russians have been very good at developing extremely effective jamming systems that degrade the performance of Ukrainian drones at a very high rate, not completely eliminating the problem from them, but extraordinarily reducing the problem from them. They have also innovated tremendously with air power. They have effectively used drones to force the exhaustion of the Ukrainian air defenses, ground-based air defenses. These geranium drones are a tremendous problem, because if you're an air defense like a Patriot and these things are coming at you, they are extremely easy to shoot down because they travel slowly, they have large radar cross sections, but you can't ignore them because they have significant bomb payloads. So you have to shoot at them. And if you're shooting at them, you're shooting a $4 or $5 million interceptor at a $20 or $30 or $40,000 drone. And it's probably less than that, because now that the Russians are manufacturing their own, it's probably much less than the cost of importing them from Turkey. So they have extremely effectively taken advantage of drones as a method for exhausting air defenses. Not to mention, of course, there are all the traditional ways of doing it, where you destroy the air defenses, you find them through radio direction finding, and you go in and attack them. But that's always more difficult. It's more expensive, because modern interceptors and air defenses have really become extraordinarily capable. All this sensor technology that's built into the interceptors and the radars, and the extremely sophisticated homing algorithms that can now be implemented in these missiles, really makes it not a very good game if you're in an airplane being shot at by advanced interceptors. The game is on your side if you can exhaust these interceptors, with cheap targets that the air defense must engage, you know, because if it doesn't engage them, it's going to be severely damaged or destroyed. So the Russians have quickly understood this. And it's not just a fact you understand, you have to understand that you need large numbers of these drones, that you need to deploy them efficiently. All of this has been implemented with elegance, with precision and quantity by the Russians. And then, of course, now that they have control of the air, they have been able to keep their air force casualties low by using glide bombs, by putting these glide kits on the bombs. And the bombs they are using, some of them have fantastic yields, some of these 3,000 kilogram bombs. And then, of course, you have a mix of 250 kilogram bombs. And that mix is important because many times you have an installation you want to hit and you want to limit the damage because maybe your troops are in there. So they have a tremendously versatile menu of yields that they can pick from for these bombs. And they are using them with great skill. So they can do bring unbelievable firepower and death and fire on these poor, hapless Ukrainian forces while allowing their own forces to be in close if they choose to. And many times they don't choose to, so they're keeping their casualties much lower. It was just a little item. I don't know. I can't be sure exactly what it meant, but I guess the Russians and the Ukrainians exchanged dead bodies just the other day. And the Russians got 45 dead bodies in exchange for 200. I don't know if that indicates a 4-to-1 killing ratio, but my guess is the ratio is at least 3-to-1. I've sort of estimated that on my own. And I think it could be 4-to-1 at this point because the Russians are very carefully limiting the exposure of their troops. And to be on the offensive and to be inflicting so much more damage to your adversary is counter to what usually happens in offensive operations against defensive operations. Because when you're on the offensive, you're out in the open and the enemy you're going after is dug in. And so you almost always have to suffer more casualties even to defeat an enemy that you're quite superior to. But the Russians in this particular situation have beaten that game. They found a way at this time, maybe it won't be true in the future wars, to really keep an extraordinarily aggressive and successful offensive operation going at a very low cost in casualties when you consider the scale of these operations. So one has to accept that the Russian forces are formidable. Now, if they went up against a truly modernized and capable Western European force, maybe they wouldn't have control of the air uncontested as much as they have in this situation. But even that's not clear because the European militaries are so denuded of capability these days. They've given so much of their equipment away to Ukraine, and they've also failed to keep their forces properly funded, which in my view would be a good thing. In other words, if they didn't drive the Russians to produce a highly capable offensive army, it was them who drove the Russians to do this, then having a small defense budget, which they've pretty much done for the last decades or more, and allowing the Russians to do the same, and allowing for mutual respect and security in Europe, then we would be in a much better situation. And, you know, in 1990, I was really hoping we would be in that situation. But I watched and fought in the United States, because I had a program at MIT where we invited Russian scholars, physicists. I'm a physicist by training, and we had a liaison with the Moscow Physical Technical Institute, which is their version of MIT. And let me tell you, they are impressive. The people they have, their students are really impressive. And we had a regular exchange of these students, and we would work together on issues of common concern to both Russia and the United States. That's the way we tried to focus the program. And these people were off scale in capability, and they were not hostile to the United States. They were very balanced, very non-ideological, very interested in building bridges to the United States. And I watched them get fingers pushed in their eyes at every opportunity. I was involved at one point in a classified panel where we were talking about developing technologies that would be useful for military and security applications, you know, non-proliferation, detecting the sources of nuclear materials that might be might be intercepted, you know, very exotic technologies. And I would constantly listen to these people from the American weapons labs talking about how they got some Russian scientists to share a set of technologies that Russia had developed that we knew nothing about. And while they were able to keep the Russian scientists from learning anything about our technologies, they were bragging about this. And I would say, you know, we are saying this was in Gorbachev and the West was talking about a complete loss of you know, we were going to be partners and
I'm looking Gorbachev, at Gorbachev, then Yeltsin.
Yeah, and I'm sitting there, and I'm not afraid to say what I think, as you probably understand. And I'm sitting in the meeting. I'm just an academic. I don't care if they don't want me there. I mean, I'm happy to work for my government if I can do something constructive. I don't want to be part of anything that's not constructive. So it doesn't matter to me if they throw me out, which they did, incidentally. But and it didn't, you know, it didn't matter to me. I just said, okay, I'm sorry, because I'd like to be of help. But on the other hand, you know, I'm not going to participate in something that's negative. And they were just delighted right from the beginning to put it to the Russians. And especially at that time, the attitude was, we're never going to hear from them again. You know, they're finished. And I remember sitting there and saying, you know, if you think these guys are finished, you really don't understand history. And you don't understand culture either, because Russian culture is a great culture with great traditions in science and engineering and the arts and literature. And if you think these guys are finished, you've got the wrong idea, because their society is in a shambles at this point, just as our society was in a shambles during the Great Depression. And nobody quite knew how to pull it out, because it was a structural problem, not having to do with the talents and capabilities of the people involved. And if you think these guys are going to be on their backs forever, you are making a gigantic mistake. And it's really better that they get on their feet and they're our friends rather than our enemies. And I used to say that. But now they're our enemies, not my enemy, but, you know, they're, you know, we've turned them into a furious, implacable enemy for reasons that unfortunately are well justified. We've lied to them politically. We've, I mean, Putin has been very clear about being misled. It's been very clear to me, as I've watched Putin very carefully, he has tried numerous times to negotiate with the West, to do something constructive with the West. And without failure, the West has turned around and done something completely opposing, completely opposite to constructive. So, you know, I laugh at you know, there's this the United States in 2009, Hillary Clinton, who is one of the biggest problems that we've had in terms of our foreign policy, and the cadres of people like Anthony Blinken and Jake Sullivan, who she's produced. You know, she starts what do they call it, the Russian reset. And I remember looking at this, and the Russians were very concerned about this missile defense system we were building, this ground-based missile defense system. And Clinton comes up with this idea of a sea-based missile defense system. I remember I was sitting in my office, and somebody in the president's science advisor's office actually called me and said, "What do you think of this?" And I said, "Have you ever read the ABM Treaty of 1972? Do you understand that mobile missile defense systems were banned because of the uncertainties that mobile systems would have created, that would have led to pressures to expand offensive nuclear forces because of those uncertainties? Do you understand? Was there anybody in the White House who knew anything about the terms of the ABM treaty, even to discuss why this system was, not a good idea? And by the way, do you know that the radars on the ships are not capable of seeing warheads at long enough range to be able to launch interceptors so it can't work, and that the interceptors are too slow to be able to work? So all you're all doing here is creating a tremendous appearance of trying to create a system, but incompetently trying to create a vast system of defenses against the Russians. And also, by the way, you are violating the INF treaty, because those launchers you're putting into Poland and Romania are capable of launching nuclear armed cruise missiles. They're designed to be able to launch nuclear armed cruise missiles. And, you know, this guy, McFaul was the person implementing this part of the restart, of the reset. And he didn't even know. I know this for a fact, because at one point I talked to him. He didn't even know that they were violating the INF treaty. That's how politicized this guy is, and how much he lacks in basic technical knowledge. Now, so what this tells me, since I'm a technical person, and since I was an advisor to the Chief of Naval Operations in the Pentagon, and I saw a lot of civilians as well as military decision making, this tells me that nobody with technical expertise was consulted by the people who were discussing the policy options as they understood it. In other words, it was just a group of characters, all of whom were trained as political scientists or lawyers, who never thought to ask the technical community for input. So when this guy McFarland comes up with all these sanctions, I doubt he's ever talked to an economist. You know, when I was in the Pentagon and I was working on a technical issue, I'd always go to the military officers and I'd say, look, I have this technical problem I'm trying to understand. What does this mean to you? If you're in a submarine and I have this technical situation, I have this, how do you deal with it? Or do you deal with it? Or what are the issues that are concerned? Because I'm trying to understand the expertise of the professional who's been at, I've never been at sea. So I'm trying to understand from these highly knowledgeable, capable professionals, what their understanding of a given situation might be. You know, so you go and you talk to people who have the expertise if you're involved in making decisions of one kind, even about technology, especially about technology, because the tactical environment is very critical. It, you know, your technology can be advanced, but if a tactical environment doesn't work for you, it's useless. It's in fact can be negative. And so it's clear to me that these people never, and I mean never, even tried to consult with knowledgeable people on the technical issues, on the economic issues. They just flying by the seat of their pants. It's incredible. It's incredible to me. And that's what you see. If you take this picture that I just laid out for you and ask, how do I explain the decision making in the White House? It fits perfectly. This is total, you know, because the alternative theory, if you want to call it that, is that their objective is to do as much damage to the United States and West as they possibly can. And that's what's driving their decision making. And I don't think that's likely to be the case. I think they somehow believe they know what they're doing, which is incredible to me by itself, and they just don't consult any expertise. And if they hear anything from expertise, they don't listen to it.
Yeah. It's pretty amazing.
I'm sorry. It's stunning. Pitch. I agree with you. It's stunning.
Yeah, it's unbelievable how yeah. Because we see the outcome of this type of thinking, this type of mindset in Ukraine right now, and God forbid if we can have it the same in Taiwan, and I don't know what would happen.
If I were Ukrainian, I would hate this guy Zelensky. I'm speaking as a Ukrainian now. What he is doing is he is killing his own people at a fantastic rate in order to try to make it appear to a group of total ignoramuses in the West that something is happening that could save Ukraine. Ukraine has lost this war. There is nothing that can save Ukraine unless the Russians, for some completely unknown reason, decide to put down their arms and go home. Otherwise, nothing can save Ukraine, nothing at all. This war is totally lost. The Russians have not even begun to bring in the full military power they have at their disposal. They have 300,000 troops, fresh, fully trained, fully equipped, ready to inject into Ukraine right now. There's nothing you can do. You know, no. So the best thing to do is to try to stop the killing. That's what I think is the most important thing to do. So when Zelensky calls up these young people in Ukraine, first of all, he's destroying his economy because somebody's got to work. And the younger people are usually more energetic. They often are fresh out of educational institutions. So they, you know, they're fresh and more innovative. Of course, they're of an age where they're raising families. I mean, the hole in the demography of Ukraine in the future, it's going to be a black hole because of what they've done to their reproductive generations now. And what he's doing is he's pouring more innocent people into the hole to be chopped up. These people have no chance on the battlefield unless they've got a year of training, 6 months or 3 months of training to go into a combat environment like that and survive. It's murder. It's simply murder. And these guys are doing it without a second thought. They're not patriots. You can't be a patriot and do that to your own people. You talk to a military officer, and I know a lot of them, because I respect and admire these guys, the ones who are smart, and I know a bunch of smart ones. And the first thing they'll tell you is, my duty is to my soldiers. You know, maybe I'll have to tell a unit, you need to fight to the death because we must have that delay of the enemy advance to set up our defenses and counter attack because, you know, we're in jeopardy. But you never send them to be murdered for no reason at all. You never do that. And how can you expect your troops to have any respect for you or loyalty? I mean, if I were an Iraqi soldier during the Gulf War wars, I would have taken off my shoes and run in the sand too. Why would you want to die for some monster who couldn't give a damn about your life or your country? So I have to say, I am amazed and impressed that Ukrainian forces have not yet collapsed, because these people are fighting. They have no hope, and they are not being treated with respect. Their lives are not being treated with respect by their own leadership. It's really a sad situation.
Yeah. When you look at the situation right now in Ukraine, do you think before this conflict started, Russia was willing to negotiate on the eastern part of Ukraine, just give them some sort of autonomy and building up on Minsk 1 and Minsk 2? They were talking about these things in Istanbul, even after the invasion of Ukraine. And right now, how do you see the current phase? Do you think that Russia would capture Odessa, Nikolaev? Odessa is so important for Ukrainians and for Russians. But the way that the Biden administration is handling the situation right now in Ukraine, it seems to me that at the end of the day, Russia would take Odessa. What's your take on this?
I have no way of knowing what Russia would do, but I can put myself in Putin's shoes. I shouldn't say Putin, Russia's shoes, because he has a lot of advisors, some of whom are pretty nasty.
Yeah.
And I don't see, what I would basically be aiming for is I would aim to take the entire Black Sea coast of Ukraine, because the Western strategy has been to isolate Russia by pushing it out of the Black Sea. And I would do that just as a matter of insurance. That, of course, Odessa, my grandmother came from Odessa. They were Jews, but my grandmother always called herself a Russian. She never called herself Ukraine. It was never, I didn't even know who Ukrainians were. I mean, she was Russian. And, you know, so that's a Russian city. And, so I would take back those areas because they'll be easy to govern, because they're basically Russian culturally and historically. I would probably not bother to go into Western Ukraine, because the Western Ukrainians hate Russians. At least that part of Ukraine is, all these Bandera lovers, Stepan Bandera lovers. And I do not think it's as much a group of Nazis as Putin likes to make the claim, but I do think he's right about the government. The government has all these Bandera admirers, and they are supremacists of some, you can call them white supremacists. I don't know what kind of, they're just Ukrainian supremacists. I guess a white supremacist is one way to describe them. They have managed to take over the government. And the reason they've managed to take over the government is because the United States arranged for it. Because if you look at the way the American CIA operates, and the American intelligence community operates, they always go to support the most extreme right-wing elements in a country they want to take over. And the reason for this is not even political. It's not that they're right-wing and extremists, although they effectively are such, the same. But it's because the right-wing extremists are the most well-organized. They have the weapons and they're willing to use them. And so, when you go into Chile and you depose a lawfully elected president, Allende, you go and you find some extremist who is going to murder people and keep control of the countries and is going to be friendly to you, whatever that means. And so you plunge the country into an extreme autocratic, brutal, murderous dictatorship. And that's what happened in Iran too. And so that's why the United States intelligence agencies are always supporting these extreme groups, because the measure of what constitutes what we claim, I say this with some shame as an American, what we claim as a democracy is in fact a right-wing, autocratic, brutal regime that we somehow rig up as a democracy and as an open society, when in fact it's not that at all. So, I mean, you look at Ukraine, this is not a, 30% of the people who have Russian cultural connections are supposed to be citizens, but they can't embrace those connections. I mean, how can you talk? I mean, the United States, we have problems with racism against Asians, racism against Blacks. If we institutionalized it, it would be, of course, it is institutionalized, but not formally in the legal system, at least, although the legal system doesn't function adequately to protect these minorities. But if we did this as a country, we would correctly be identified as a country that is not a democracy. And these other countries are doing this, and we have people standing up talking about we're saving democracy. I mean, I'm sort of speechless when I listen to this. I want to say something, but it seems to me that what can you say when this is the kind of stuff that, I'm talking to this guy McFaul. He's talking, I'm saving democracy, and I said, how is this a democracy? I point this, how is this a democracy? And he doesn't know how to answer me. I mean, it's not that he comes back at me and says, you're wrong, your facts are wrong. He just stops in his tracks. He just doesn't know what to say, because he's so used to being in a bubble where he says this to his other buddies in the bubble and everyone repeats it. And then someone says, well, wait a second here, Mike. I don't understand. I'm just a physicist. I'm just trained as a scientist. Explain it to me. These are the facts that I know. Tom, show me where these facts are wrong. And of course, he just freezes up. He just doesn't know what to say. And it's this bubble these people are in. I see it all over the place.
We don't know anything about what they're talking about when they're talking about non-strategic nuclear weapons and what's the difference between nuclear weapons and non-strategic nuclear weapons. How do you draw the difference between these weapons?
Well, I first of all, the type of weapon just has to do with its application. I mean, a nuclear weapon is a nuclear weapon. Now, if I want to destroy cities with my nuclear, of course, the claim is we Americans don't attack cities. We just attack the industrial base, the of the enemy, which of course happens to be a city. But we would never engage in a genocidal act of targeting cities. It's just against our moral values. But if you have weapons that you want to destroy large industrial complexes, economic and industrial complexes like which happen to be cities, you tend to use larger yield nuclear weapons because they have a larger destructive radius, and you can cover more area. And so, so the weapons tend to be in the hundreds of kilotons yields, or in basically in the, I call it fractional megaton yield, because a 100 kiloton warhead is a tenth of a megaton, and that's a lot of power. Now, if you want to try attack a troop concentration, and you want it to be fairly targeted. Now, one of the troop concentrations you might be thinking of attacking is when I'm attacking your forces in a conventional war. What I'll try to do is concentrate my military capabilities into a very small area, have a very high density of armored equipment, troops on the ground, and I'll try to find a weak point in your defenses and overwhelm the defensive installations at that weak point, because a modern mechanized army is going to have a line of defense, and behind that line of defense is going to be a lot of logistical supply capabilities, trucks carrying things. These are not armed vehicles. These are not vehicles that can fight. They are bringing weapon materials to the front where the claws and the teeth are trying to tear the heart out of the enemy, but they don't have any capability to fight. So what I try to do is punch through these defensive lines and then spread out behind those lines and basically destroy the logistical infrastructure that's keeping the lines that are fighting alive with ammunition, food, water, and so forth. And ammunition is the big, heavy quantity. Petroleum is the next one, and then food is almost incidental. And in terms of weight, of difficulty of transfer. And if I can succeed in doing that, then the lines to the left and right of my initially successful defense, they will quickly collapse. And my forces, which are lined up, ready to take advantage of that quick collapse, can then cause a general disintegration of the forces in front of me. So that's the strategy. And of course, if you can do it, you're going to win. Now, what happened in the summer of 2023 is the Ukrainians delusionally thought that they could do this. And they thought that they could have these offensive punches into the Surovikin defensive line that had been built by the Russians. And of course, nobody in the Western military had done any homework understanding what the Surovikin line was. These guys were used to fighting third world, third class armies like the Iraq's army. So when you look at Desert Storm, when we had these Abrams tanks out in De Desert Storm, we had night vision. The Iraqis did not have night vision. So we, I talked to soldiers who were involved, and we'd come trundling along and at night, and all of a sudden, we'd see the soldiers, not me, because I'm not a soldier. So our soldiers would see through their night vision capabilities. They'd see these little bright balls of brightness. Well, those were the heads of Iraqi tank commanders sitting behind earthworms waiting for the Americans to come. So they knew the location of every tank because below that little ball of light was a tank. And these tanks, these Abrams tanks, had superb gun sights and guns. And we were destroying Iraqi tanks right through piles of dirt that they had piled up in front of their tanks and destroying the tanks, just shooting right through the piles of dirt. We didn't even see the piles of dirt. We just knew that the tank commander's head was there, so there was a tank under them. It was a massacre. Now, that's not the situation you have in Ukraine now. I mean, you have adversaries who have much better armor. They are much better trained. They are very skilled in the use of their armor. They have artillery to help them. They have terrain to help them. They don't have this flat terrain where they're just exposed, and all the only sensible thing the Iraqis could do would be run. The only sensible thing to do when you countered American armor in that war would simply be run. I talked to one soldier. He was at a he was at a, I think it was a battalion headquarters, so they were set up in tents, so they were not in a position. And some Iraqi armored group came upon them in a sandstorm, and these characters just picked up, they're American soldiers. They're very well trained and disciplined. They picked up their guns and went out to fire at them. When the Iraqis realized there were American soldiers in front of them, if they knew what they were doing, they just would have rolled over them. They were in the armor. There was no hope of, they just got out of their tanks and ran. And, I don't laugh at that, like some people do, that they're cowards. I think they were pretty smart because they didn't know where the armor was. They would have had no chance. So this is a different war. And now, the Russians have absolutely superb equipment, and it's not polished like the American equipment is. And of course, the American equipment needs a lot of maintenance that the Russian equipment is designed not to need. One of the things you ought to be thinking about when you build a weapon system is this thing's going to be in the mud. It's going to be shot at. It's going to have levels of damage. The crews are going to, be sitting in it for long periods of time, and it's going to be under severe conditions of weather, and there's going to be all kinds of things falling on it. And you really have to make sure that this thing is usable under adverse conditions, and that doesn't go into American design considerations. So they're arguing about whether to make this thing light enough to swim properly, but they're not thinking about making sure that a small component makes the thing unusable if you're in combat. And, the design strategies have not been good in the West, and we're seeing that. We've seen that. So the West is, I mean, I think there's a lot of excellent, well studied military people in the West who understand these things. I mean, it's kind of silly that I'm talking about them, because you go talk to Dan Davis or some of these other characters. I mean, they'll tell you off the top of their head this kind of thing. But that is a lesson that the American military leadership should have known, and they didn't. And they look, and they never really studied the Surovikin line, because when you looked at that Surovikin line, you'd have to say to yourself, how is anybody going to get through it? I mean, the only good thing, I mean, when they first attacked in Zaporizhia, the at least Zaluzhny had the common sense to stop the forward attack after 3 or 4 days, where they had all these vehicles lined up and all these dead soldiers. because they couldn't even get through the minefields, let alone get to the actual line that was set up for to trap them and wear them down and destroy them all. And they just kept on going at this thing. Now, how can you do that? I mean, where is your learning curve? The only sensible thing to have done would be to set up a defensive barrier and hope that, you know, you can pull together enough forces over time to keep the Russians from gaining more ground. You had no opportunity. There was nothing to make anyone who was competent to believe that you could ever penetrate that line and go to the Sea of Azov. Nothing, nothing at all. And I was talking to Dan about, I was going to, one of the talks he was asking me about is, I said, you know, I was stunned to read in the Washington Post that they were, that the American Pentagon people did simulations to determine how well they could do. I don't believe that. I don't believe that for a second. I told Dan, if you want, I can put together a discussion for your audience that explains why simulations could never predict the outcome of a battle. They can be useful in evaluating why a battle was lost or won. You can use computer simulations to study what happened after it's happened, but and to get a better insight. But to predict, this is not predicting the phases of the moon. This is not a physical system. You have no way of knowing what the, you know, if the tank has a vegetation in front of it, he doesn't have a clean sight to the enemy. If they're rolling hills, not flat ground, he doesn't have a clean sight to the enemy. If the enemy is to his flank, because he's inadvertently gone in too deep, he doesn't know that he's going to be hit from the side, from the flank. You can't simulate that kind of serendipity. I'll call it serendipity in combat. And you can understand it. You can, you know, look at the situation. You say, oh yeah, this guy got himself in too deep. He was in this tank. Maybe the advance shouldn't have been so aggressive, you know. And so you can teach your soldiers, you know, train your soldiers, you expose them to the insights that come from these kinds of simulations, but you can't predict anything. You have no idea what you're doing if you think those things can predict things. And here they're talking about, well, we did this simulation and, you know, we came up, you know, there was like a 50% chance they could get through in 90 days. I mean, there was a 0% chance they could get through. The chance was 100% that they were going to be destroyed if they continued on the offensive. That's what the situation was if you were a knowledgeable military officer looking at the. I can only imagine, I've been in the Pentagon and seen these exercises done. I can only imagine these 3 and 4 star generals talking to each other while a bunch of colonels and lieutenant colonels who know far more about what really happens in battle are sitting there trying to say to themselves, should I say something or not? I could just see these guys, you know, because I've been in meetings where I come out of the meeting, I'm with a bunch of naval officers and I'm with these guys, they're at lower levels and I'm with all these admirals and these officers are my friends. I made friends with them over time. They say, don't these guys understand that this is crazy? because the officers who are closer to combat experience understand what can and cannot, which is why when I was a technical person thinking about technical solutions, I would always be asking them, is this a help to you or not? Or is this worse than what you have? So there's no reality to what they were doing. It was shocking to me to find out that they were simulating these things. It's just extraordinary.
The Biden administration seems to not understand anything what's going on between Russia and Ukraine. At the same time,
No.
you see, right now Russians are talking about nuclear bombs. Hey guys, every time they're talking about we have nuclear bomb, be cautious of what you're doing right now. But at the same time, you see in the West, in the Biden administration, these four-star general who you were talking about them, and they, when they are coming to the mainstream media, CNN, ABC, CNBC, these mainstream media, they're talking, no, Russia is not going to attack. Russia is not going to use nuclear bombs. It's not, you know, it's unbelievably disconnected with the reality of what's going on between Russia and NATO. And these people send Ukraine to some sort of black hole right now, and
Well,
they're still talking about the use of nuclear bomb is impossible.
it's not at all impossible. In fact, I won't say it's probable, but I think it's quite possible. And I'm extremely concerned about this. It's part of the reason why I gave a talk on what a nuclear attack might look like in Dan Davis's program. And because I have no problem understanding what situations could lead to nuclear use. I've studied it throughout my life. And what's motivated me throughout my life to study this so carefully, and I've studied it very carefully and very deeply, is my fear that it could happen. In other words, my hope has been that having deep knowledge of these issues could provide people with the warning they need to get to understand how dangerous these things are. If you look at things I published over the years, I published a bunch of articles that did nothing more than explain what a series of nuclear detonations in war could be. That's literally all they tried to do. They didn't try to get into scenarios. I'll be honest with you. My joke with my wife is my aim was to scare the bejesus out of these people with the truth, just because the truth is so scary with these weapons that you need to, because people have a generalized feeling that these things are bad. You know, they're bad, you know, and oh yeah, which is good. It's good that they think they're bad. And I theorize, I of course don't know, that the reason we did not get into a nuclear war during the Cold War was because the average political decision maker knew nothing about the effects of nuclear weapons, but had the idea in their head that the world was going to end if we got involved in them. They were really scared of these things. And that's good. That's good. That probably saved us. When I was working for the Congress as a much younger guy, I remember being asked by a very conservative senator, Jake Garn was his name. I disagreed with his politics and everything, but I really liked him. I mean, I wasn't in a position to like or not, but I liked the man. He was just a real decent kind of person, although I didn't agree with his politics. And at one point during a briefing I was giving him, because he was an important member of Congress, he asked me what a nuclear attack on multiple protective shelters, which was this crazy idea that we were going to deploy MX missiles all over the southwest of the United States in desert installations. And I had studied it in great detail. So I sort of calmly explained to him, well, you know, the first wave would attack the northernmost, the southernmost missile sites because you'd have these debris clouds rising, and you don't want to have to fly through them when you attack the other ones. So you'd start south and you'd walk north, and I'd explain to him how these debris clouds could present, and you know the radiation, and I, you know, and this was a man that in public, when he was in public, he would say, I like the MX deployment scheme because we could deploy 2,000 missiles in 2,000 shelters instead of 200 missiles in 4,000 shelters. You know, the idea was 200 shelters and 200 missiles to be hidden among 4,000 shelters. So the good thing, you know, he talk about this, you know, on Congress, you know, because he wants to be tough. He wants to show he's tough. But let me tell you, the eyeballs in this guy were going like a slot machine. He was scared to death. I wasn't trying. I was, you know, I realized he was scared to death. I wasn't intending to scare him. I was just, he asked me a question. I had studied it in great detail because I was concerned about what could happen if we had a nuclear war. And I could see the next day he got up in Congress and he made the same statement. It's good we have this system with 4,000 shelters because we could put 4,000 missiles in all of them. So when he's in public, he's saying one thing. When he's in private, there's another. But what I recall that was really a powerful lesson to me, and I've seen it time and again, was that when he's sitting there trying to think about what he would actually have to do if he had a decision to make, he's scared to death. And that, to me, is very good. It shows that he has a grasp on reality. So I'm not making fun of him at all, because I had great respect for him. He's a politician. Understandably, he's concerned about how to manipulate the political situation to achieve his political objectives. But my problem with the political people I've seen more recently is they don't have objectives. They don't know what their objectives are. Like Mike McFaul said, I asked him, what's your objective? He says, well, I want to get rid of Putin. I said to him, well, how are you going to do that? He says, well, I don't know. I said, you want to get rid of Putin, but you don't know? I mean, what are you talking about? He says, well, we're America. We can, we'll figure it out. I said, what are you kidding? And this was literally the conversation we had. I said to him, what are you kidding? What do you mean we're America? You know? So this is the mindset of these people. They have no, you know, they don't know why they hate Putin, you know, because they become the victim of their own propaganda, because every time they have screwed up and Putin and his cabinet, which is, he's not in a small, he has good people around him who know what they're talking about. When he and his cabinet figure out ways to block off what the Americans are attempting, they have to make an excuse. So they go to the Chinese and they sell the Chinese. You have to stop selling those Russians commercial chips, you know, even though the commercial chips can go into a washing machine or a Lancet drone. We don't want you selling it because you're aiding them. Well, what do you mean? What's the Chinese supposed to do? Stop having a commercial relationship with Russia because you're concerned that they build chips and the Russians are buying them, you know, in exchange for gas and oil that the Chinese need, because the Chinese are worried that with all your saber rattling, you're going to cut off their access to the Middle East oil and gas. You know, what are you thinking when you go there? You know, how can you, I mean, I don't even understand what you can be thinking when you go to people who you should understand that these are their concerns. You don't have to agree with them. You don't have to like them. You don't have to not see them as a competitor or an adversary. I don't see the Chinese this way, incidentally. I don't see any reason why there needs to be a military confrontation between the United States and China. And let me say something, and I'm going to say this as loudly and as often as I can, if this nonsense continues in the United States. I'm going to say, if you think you lost the war in Ukraine, because by that point, it'll be evident to the average American, you won't be able to hide it. I'm going to say, if you think you lost the war in Ukraine, wait till you get into a naval war with China near its own borders. You're going to lose aircraft carriers. You're going to lose flotillas of ships. This is going to be a historical failure that will be embedded in the history of the United States right with the Revolutionary War when we first had it. And you better figure this out because you don't want to start a fight with somebody who's as capable as the Chinese, because they're not going to fight you across the world. They don't want to fight you across the world. They're not interested in fighting you across the world. They're only interested in getting you off their back. And they're in a position to do it, just as the Russians are only interested in getting the Western powers in the United States off their back. Russians don't need Western Europe. What, this idea is they want to go in and take, why would you want to take Western Europe? What do you want? What are you, Nazi Germany? I mean, this is not Nazi Germany. The Russians just want to have a prosperous society. They want to be respected. They want to live good lives. They want their children to do well. They want their grandchildren to live. They're no different than anybody else in the world. Instead, we talk, they eat their children, it's just ridiculous. The American mentality is, the political mentality is so amazing to me. I don't, I'm just dumbfounded when I listen to these people talk. So, but there is a great danger.
Yeah. Just to wrap up this session, do in your opinion, Putin, we know that when Putin came to power in at the end of the 1999 and 2000, he was so much pro Europe, even pro United States. He wanted to be part of the Western society.
No
He
question.
wanted to be part of the security of Europe. But we didn't have we don't we didn't have anything coming from the West embracing what Putin wanted to have with them. How do you see, do you think with the current situation right now, we've seen that in recent visit of Putin to China, just Chinese leader, that she was embracing Putin and he knows how important Russia is for the future of China. They have a country, huge country. China is a huge country that needs energy, needs security. That would be provided by Russia, Iran, Saudi Arabia, UAE. They have everything. And right now, do you see any sort of wisdom in the United States to change the game, or the train has already left the station?
Well, I think they could change the game if they had a clue about what they were doing. I mean, they could change the game quickly by just talking to the Russians and trying to figure out an agreeable outcome to this terrible war, getting NATO out of Ukraine, because that's what the Russians want. They don't want NATO on their border, and basically agreeing not to be constantly hostile and constantly trying to undermine Russia. Now, is that possible? No, because you're talking to people who are so ignorant that it's astonishing. I just don't even know how to begin to describe it. I've been giving you examples during my but it's doable. It's doable in a heartbeat, I think. But it's not going to happen because you have people who have convinced themselves that somehow the evil empire is Russia. So ridiculous, it's, I've already said it. And, if, and as long as they continue doing this, I think Putin has figured out that he has no leverage of any kind. In other words, he can't hold out a feather of friendship, because every time he's tried, he's had his hand lopped off. And it's like, trying to convince a hungry alligator that you really don't mean any harm and you'd like to work with him. It's the history of this is unmistakable. There's no question in my mind that Putin wanted to accommodate the West. He was also, of course, a patriot, and he wants to accommodate Russia, and he wants Russia to be a safe and secure country and a prosperous country. And he worked on the prosperity of Russia right from the beginning. Right from the beginning, he brought in economists to try to bring, you know, he deserves an enormous amount of credit for starting right in 2000 to try to bring the economic disaster that was created under Yeltsin under control. You know, he immediately, for example, started an income tax arrangement where it was everybody paid the same taxes, which is a regressive thing, but he was just trying to get people to pay their taxes because nobody was paying their taxes under Yeltsin. And now he's introducing a tax that taxes the wealthy more strongly than the poor. You know, so all of these economic reforms started immediately under his leadership. Yes, there was also military reforms, because only a fool thinks that you're going to be okay, especially if you're Russia. Maybe if you're Costa Rica, you could not have an army because of your local environment, and you can just say, I want to be peaceful. I don't want to waste money on the military. That's a great arrangement for them. I applaud them for doing that. But if you're Russia, with the history and the crowd who lives around you, you'd be crazy not to want a relatively capable defensive military. Now, he's had to build an offensive military, but it's an offensive military of limited scope. He can't take Europe with that military. He doesn't want to. He doesn't need to. Who needs the headache? Look at these guys. They can't even get along with each other. What do you want to occupy? I mean, what a group of clowns they are, you know? So he doesn't want that. I'm always amazed. Oh, Putin wants this. Putin wants. I don't know what Putin wants, but it's clear to me that's not what he wants. So in any case, I think all of this is solvable if the Western leadership had two neurons to rub together and started thinking clearly. It could be turned around very quickly.